I got it. I got this intro, you guys. This is a good, this is meat and taters. And if you're vegan, it's, what's a really full vegan meal?
Tempeh?
I've not found one.
This is, this is tempeh and like that's, mill or what, something coming, mill.
That's saying something coming for Justin, because he doesn't even eat. I'm pretty sure Justin photosynthesizes half of it.
He is established for energy, photosynthesis. This, what I'm saying is there's a lot in this podcast. This is we were talking about we start off with some cues for music, right? We were talking about music and what we listen to get pumped up for training. You know, whether that's, you know, ragey rock or NPR.
The sonorous voice
right.
of
right. podcast. The soothing podcast voice. Then we are diving right in to coaching communication, coaching approach, the way that we like to talk to students, some of those faux pas, and just some really great heartfelt advice about how to communicate with your students and approach coaching if you are coaching. And if you're just somebody who works with kids and has interaction with kids, or you're trying to show them parkour, or you're trying to show them some other stuff, this is a really good approach. Maybe you're just a parent who's trying to work on their communication style. I think there could be some value derived there. It's pretty awesome. So you can check the timestamp in the notes for the podcast and skip forward to that part, or you can get
you can join us for the whole journey.
Join us for the whole journey. It's a good one. All that and more on this episode of The Outrun Show. They're like, no, we're just going with bagpipes. Keep a beat with a bagpipe. No, I don't even know there's a melody. It's generally just like an elk crying.
Dude, yeah, but like bagpipes, were bagpipes originally designed for like war?
Yup, yup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is an intimidating sound if you just hear this, like.
You know, you're about to
you're like, that's, seconds I don't, later. You're like, it's like oddly musical. But also sounds like a herd of animals harmonizing that are gonna like come crush me.
You're right.
But I also still kind of like it. It's like it sounds good.
You just
like
that, all pumped up. But I don't want to be on the wrong end of it.
The dichotomy makes you, yeah, a shitty offensive.
It's fighter. Like shooting a gun and being shot at.
Yeah.
If you shoot the gun, it feels very cool and powerful.
Yeah.
If you're being shot at. Quite the opposite.
Very uncool. You feel very powerless.
Yes.
True.
Exactly. So.
All right. Let's get started.
I feel like that was it. That was the whole thing.
That's it. We're done.
That was it. Calling it good. We're done. So that totally leads into the topic of music.
It does actually.
So it gets you all pumped up. So bagpipes is just reworkout. Yeah, we've been going. We don't stop. We can't stop.
I thought he refused to start it, but that was your refuse to stop it.
No, and you looked at me and said, click it. You looked away and I clicked it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we go hard on Earth.
Yeah. Impromptu, live, go live.
So, yeah, so the opening question here was, like, what's your, like, when you guys are going to get going and you toss in your AirPods, you know, your AirPods Pros if you're super fancy, what's the genre? Not the artist, because, you know, we're not getting paid to say their name, so they don't get any free shout-outs. But, like, you know, what's the genre that you go to and why?
Yeah, I have a genre. I actually don't. Sometimes
you're the nerd that listens to audiobooks, huh, when you're working out.
No, definitely not.
Middle of a max, like a one rep max, no. He's listening to.
I'm just the opposite. I just don't like music to pump me up. Like, I like it in the background, and I just like it like white noise.
He likes public radio to get pumped up.
Dude, he's totally listening to. What was that example
I gave
us years ago? And it was like,
yeah.
And so we noticed that grass and greenery grows more under parked cars that don't move than cars that move regularly.
I could totally do
we found
NPR.
That this type of moss actually affects the ecosystems of suburban areas, making squirrels fatter.
That, and that's,
well, that's
just
an interesting fact, Janet.
That's just
Janet.
mid one rep max right there.
Leading into the next subject with the oboe.
Yes, I like it. All right, I don't have to complain about anybody's music. All right, so when you know you're listening to your car and you got your weirdo music, I'm not gonna complain about it. Okay, and like I don't come into the gym and be like, hey, Justin, you gotta change that weird pop 90s song. It's not from the 80s, so I don't want it playing in the gym anymore.
But,
all right? Hey, that's how I am. Anything will work. Any sound, I'm going.
Anything?
Yeah. So this is also the guy who, like, was it yesterday we went over to do some, like, turf recon at another gym? We were doing a little reconnaissance. Nice. Making sure the turf
don't like glaze over the turf recon element of this story, all right? I got dragged into turf recon.
Well, I think
knew it wasn't your idea.
No. I think that turf recon is totally a Travis idea. But the idea is that you get some exposure. Like, you're gonna, like, one of the biggest things about building new buildings, like we're doing this new gym, is regret. And so you want to explore your options. You want to know you looked at other stuff. If you go down the street and see someone else's stuff and like, oh my gosh, that's so simple, we could have done it. It's like the type of thing that bothers me. So I like to see the options to know at least there wasn't some low-hanging fruit I missed to make things cool. So I wanted Justin to come see the turf at this other gym. And I'm standing outside the gym waiting like a couple minutes. And I'm like, oh man, he must have snuck in there. They've already got him. They're trying to rope him into a membership. We can't sneak past front desk.
Dude, Justin's such a nice guy. He's like, what do I got to pay you to, like, not be a member?
I was worried that...
He's like, you know what? You seem like your job's kind of hard, so it's just like, here's $50.
I was worried that I might come in, and then he'd already be, like, signed up.
Yeah.
Or something. I mean. Anyway. But then I saw the head movement from his car, parked car, and I was like, oh, he's still in there. He must be talking to, you know, his mom or Lindsay or somebody.
Oh, no, he's jamming out.
No, he's listening to NPR. Like,
he's jamming out to NPR.
Yeah, like, I came over, and I'm like, I said to him, I'm like, what are you in there? Just, like, late listening to NPR? He's like, yeah, this topic was blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, my gosh. It was.
I like it when they use big words, all right?
But his other channel on the radio is like, my Michi Baba, right? So, like... So those are Justin's two things. It's like, it's extreme, NPR, or it's like K-pop.
It's like jumping from the hot tub to the snow. And
that is that's a good time.
There's no middle ground.
There's no middle ground. That's a good time. I think that there is some truth to, if you ever want to expand your vocabulary, you know, stop downloading like a single word app a day, which will only like single. Yeah. Single word app. The single word apps, like, it's new word of the day.
Word of the day.
Right. I mean, you can only absorb one word at best, and you don't even get real context, so it's harder. I found that just like reading comprehension, some of the listening comprehension of listening to higher vocabulary podcasts and talk shows does totally speed up your ability to like intake information or vocabulary. Like, I remember going into some podcasts and being like, I hear the words and I kind of know what they mean, but I'm not tracking. I have to pause this and rewind it, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, podcasts are kind of tough though to like pin down the word sometimes.
It is.
Kindle is nice because I can just highlight. I literally just highlight the word and it gives me the definition and then I save it. And then I go back through my Goodreads highlights and it'll show me all the words. And I'll be like, what was that again? And then I look it up again and then.
No, you're right. That's the smarter way to do it.
It works.
I'm a little lazier. I just listen to it. And then if I don't know the word, I look it up. And also, it's not often the word, it's the use of the word
context,
and the context. I'm like, oh my gosh, I lost context, right? Like, so that's what I work on.
So Justin listens to NPR.
For pre-workout?
To get hyped.
Pre-workout.
It's anything. I told you, it's anything. Any noise. It's could be a fan and I'll work out just as hard.
Mm. Are you a Sleep With A Fan guy?
Oh yeah. Sleep With Three Fans and street.
It's annoying,
noise.
Actually. Yeah.
Wow.
Super annoying.
No, it's you can't get the other way. If you go the other way and you sleep with it dead quiet, then you can never go to sleep in any other room besides.
Yeah, no, you do need a little bit of noise. That's for sure, like a white noise machine. But like, yeah, no, this guy will turn on like three fans, and then his cat will come to your dorm. And his cat's like, and I'm like, what do you want? What do you want from me? Like, hey, he's not waking up.
Some trauma from Jesse right there.
Roommate cat trauma. Yeah, you definitely want to vet people's pets before you move in with
it's,
them. That should
it's
be
so
the
hard to
question.
Get angry at her because she's 7 pounds.
Mm.
And just like, she's made of circles.
Yeah, just circle.
Like, that's how people draw animals, but the cat actually
that's
looks
how
like
you, that's
that,
Leviosa in a nutshell. It's just two circles and a tail.
And she looks pretty chunky.
With the short, stout legs.
Oh, she got little. Anyway, so Justin will listen to anything.
Yep.
There's nothing. I I'm not convinced that there's nothing that doesn't get you, like it doesn't have to be like.
We
like,
do know this is true because he listens to, what is it? Is it Justice?
Justice, yeah, he does like Justice or Pendulum.
Pendulum, yeah. So you go back to the like, Watcher 2012 demo reel.
What elevates your state of mind, right? Like, what makes you happy? To train. What makes you want to, like, do?
To specifically train?
Just do. What makes you want to do?
Yeah, not music.
It's cool.
No music. Yeah.
Sound of your own head.
Just,
yeah.
Just the vacant.
It's just too much.
Sound of
if
space.
It means if I don't have music, then that's hard for me to train. And I
it
can't
sounds
wear
like it's hard for you to train.
I know there
though.
Is truth to that. Like, some people are really dependent on that, like, training foreplay that they need
yeah,
like, they're like, oh man, I gotta get the light right, I gotta get the mute fight. Okay, am I feeling it? All right, let's go, let's train.
They
and
gotta,
that's
like,
a dependency.
Their scoop of like pre workout,
yes.
And they gotta listen to their amped up playlist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so
that's
not the right time of day. Yeah, I feel like you're right about that. For me, you know, it really depends on what I'm training actually. Like, I have about a dozen training playlists on Spotify. And I also got to record a lot of my training for review and I can't get that.
And iPhone
music.
Doesn't
yes.
record and play music?
Yes, I know. It's such an annoying feature.
All right.
They just recently changed it so where you could start watching a video without interrupting your music.
My Galaxy S, my very first like full, actually that's a lie. I had a BlackBerry Storm, which was like the first like full touchscreen device, right?
Mm.
My Galaxy S, my first Samsung that I ever got. Could play music and record a video. Come on, Apple, figure it out.
Oh, I
know. Oh, they're making a decision about it. They, you know, that the designers are back there, like, so we're gonna change this. Like, no. Tentative UX principle, Apple 1.B0. We know what I mean. Is we don't let any divergent experience occur in the interface. You must always be in the app you're working on. There's not such a thing as multitasking.
It's true, actually. How long did it take them before they allowed you to do the... Well, I guess it was this like latest update where you could snap the screen, like if you're playing a video and you could snap it and move it around while in another app.
Yeah,
it took them so long to do that. Because Android's had that feature for friggin' like 8 years now. Where you could have like 3 apps on the same screen. I don't know why you'd ever do that because it was a small device, but you could.
What are you guys doing? Like what?
Dude, I just want
to
use
watch
my device.
A video and screenshot.
Look,
and
man,
editing.
You know the setup that I'm coming from, all right? So to go from this to this and Bro. Not and only be able to do one app at a time drives me insane.
Haven't you ever seen Minority Report?
I have.
Like, we know how this. We know what the future is supposed to be like. And the future is now.
Yeah. And Apple keeps telling us revolutionary stuff, but we can't play music while recording. Mm-hmm. So anyway, sorry. I probably segue there.
Yeah, so like sometimes I'll use it to bring a particular like tone, like feeling tone into like how I'm training. That's usually how I
like
use it.
Like G sharp or something?
Well, yeah, like a bit of my mood. So sometimes I'm going in and I'm like, Travis, you're a little fatigued. You haven't recovered yet. You probably shouldn't get all psyched up and try some like, you know, high BPM stuff. Right. I'm going to go with something a little softer, a little more like 90s R&B. No, I'm kidding. I don't do train to 90s.
That's wrong
beat. Yeah, wrong mood. So, podcast frisky today. So the like if I'm training like martial arts, you know, I have this like playlist of like Eastern influenced lo-fi hip hop that I listen to.
Mm.
It's been working really good for me. And then if I'm like, I'll find something with a slower beat so that I can get through my rhythms, right? And same thing if I'm using, I have like sort of like a, yeah, another lo-fi-ish mix, maybe a little more EDM that I'll listen to without vocals for when I'm like just trying to train more mindfully in parkour, strides, look at my technique and stuff like that. And then when I'm trying to get into like a more expressive like session where I'm just trying to go and get some stuff and ride a higher level of energy, it is usually like, yeah. I have, you know, obviously I have the Synthwave playlist. I have like 3 of those. So I usually listen to those because I just feel the energy of it.
I can't listen to those when I'm like going to train though. There's like a contextual break for me on like my synth playlist, around like movement and like cyber future and that they just like, I don't know, like when I'm doing design work,
yeah,
synthwave playlist, really? Or when I'm like working in Illustrator or Photoshop, or I'm like doing code or something like that, synthwave is right in there because it feels techie and futuristic, and so does like working with tech. But when I'm moving, I need more bass. I need to get in my reptilian brain.
I could try that. When working on the computer, listening to music sounds. I never listen to like people who video games music. I don't know.
Oh, I love it.
Working on Illustrator or SketchUp for the gym, that actually might help.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Chuck, you get in that mood. Mm-hmm. In fact, yeah, yesterday it was like trying to do the math stuff, right? And then get some new designs for that stuff. And I told Carly, I was like, I'm going up in my office, turning all my lights to the friggin' like the synth colors. It can be pink and teal and turquoise and purple. Right, I'm gonna shut my door, I'm gonna put my headphones on, be playing music, I'm gonna take an edible, and I'm just gonna be in there for like 3 hours until I'm done. And she was like,
it's like
it's just in there, just
I would totally watch like Twitch streaming design, like illustration work or something like that.
Like James White, when he's working on a project, obviously there's some like confidentiality things that he probably couldn't do, but yeah, I would totally watch if he was just like playing a synth playlist and he was just doing some work, like sketching,
he does
and
that,
just Twitching.
He does it on his Instagram. Does his IGTV has
does
it.
He, does yeah. He, well, does he live stream him?
Yeah. Right. And then I think he saves them to IGTV. But also, Aleski, the other artist that we use, he does like a time lapse or a sped up with music in it, which is really cool to watch. I found that the key for me with that, because I agree with you on it, and I often like to match certain playlists with activities so they don't get like, so I can just get focused faster.
Yep.
I will use non-vocal, a little bit like harder synthwave stuff when I'm actually doing training, like Magic Sword or Carpenter Brute, stuff like that, where it's a little more like rocky, you know?
Yeah, a little hard hitting.
And I even have like a montage mix, which is just redone, 80s montage sounding songs. Like the Rocky mixes and stuff like that.
Upcycled to like newer newer beats.
And rhythms. Then I have one that is when I play, like when I'm doing some like more casual, like right now I'm doing a little experiment with my adults where I'm reintroducing some style stuff. And so as a little like sort of after school program, right? Basically it's after the hardworking adult class goes into a little program I'm experimenting with that I'm playing with that I'm calling Style Guide. And so they come in after they've trained, like, you know, they're at a hum already, and then we're gonna introduce some acrobatics, some light acrobatics, and we're gonna cartwheels and macacos and bee kicks and stuff like that. And then I'll play like your more fun, like 80s, like older 80s old school stuff, and just feels a little more like a party mix. And so it just keeps the energy like mellow, because there's a lot of intensity when adults like are like, I'm doing cartwheel for the first time in 20 years. Yep. You know what I mean?
So you take the pressure off a little bit.
Yeah, and just have a little bit of fun.
And if it's like, if you're playing something super hard, then they're like, I gotta huck it into this cartwheel.
Right, and lots of stress.
Feel the cartwheel. Let the cartwheel speak to you. Become one with the acrobatic.
The one wheel.
Alright. So Justin listens to NPR.
And what do you got? You listen to angry stuff. I've also heard you listen to like audiobooks in your car.
Yeah.
Fantasy even.
Oh yeah.
Yes, at the 1x, 1.5 or 2x speed.
It depends on the narrator.
Yeah, 1.5. Yeah,
it's like a Michael Kramer. It's like it's 1.3 because he's got a real deep voice. It's like Nick Podell, who's like my favorite narrator. He's got a nice crisp voice, so I could do 1.5. It depends. If I'm trying to get through the content, it's like educational, I want like 2x. Like just hit me with them facts, you know? But if it's for the enjoyment, then I like it a little slower. But yeah, I don't I used to listen to like audiobooks and stuff when I was working out. But that's if the workout's like just monotonous work.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I'm like, all right, it's kind of like a deload week, and so I just have to do reps, and they're not fun reps, they're just like do the thing. Mm-hmm. I'll listen to something else to kind of distract me, and because I don't want to like, it's a deload week, so I don't want to like upcycle, you know, I don't want to like really amp up my CNS for a workout that's just meant to be deloading, right? That's meant to like ease me off of like what was a really high intense week or a really high intense couple of sessions previously. So I'll just listen to something like that. But
that's even to get to like harmonic convergence, you're like deep, the deep state.
Yeah.
Where you
that we deep can't state. Say that on podcast
anymore. Oh, sorry.
Because they'll find it. They're looking for that. They're looking for deep state.
You and should be.
Gonna find our podcast.
You should be. Just take care of that stuff. So nothing to see here. Carry on, unless you want to learn about music and working out. What's yours? Yeah.
Yeah. So if it's weightlifting, I want those baser emotions. Like I want rage. Like I want anger. I want wrath. Mm. And so like what that comes in, that's usually some like old school like hip hop, like some Tupac or some 50 oh, wow. Cent or you know like DMX, like those dudes.
Holy cow.
Like that. I like that stuff. Yeah, yeah, they're angry, right? So it's either that or it's like hard rock when I'm doing like a hard lifting session. If it's like parkour training, then I want like just newer hip hop. I want some lo-fi, some like good feel, some vibe music. And then for dance, obviously, I want like all music with like a nice steady beat. That's just, you know, when you listen to a song, and then you're just like, ah, that makes me want to like just like get up and like smile. This makes me want to smile. That's the music I want to listen to when I want to dance. When I'm doing parkour, I don't want to feel angry. I don't want to feel super happy though. I want to feel just a nice like zen.
You like intensity?
I want to feel dialed in, but intense. Yeah, but not like emotionally intense. Just focused intense.
Okay. It's funny because I think that my first like really crummy, which I would have to dig out. I'm pretty sure it's just on like some. Disc somewhere like demo reel was like with a DMX song. Yeah, so yeah. I like it. I also like that you like DMX now. DMX is hilarious. You ever seen DMX like tries to use a computer on YouTube or something like that? I can't remember what it was.
No, it's tough though, because like some of the older DMX stuff is like pretty messed up,
pretty crass.
Yeah, and like I don't mind like, you know, I don't mind curse words or like stuff like that, but I can't handle like like homophobic or like racist stuff. And so like I'm like, this sucks because this song has such a good beat and rhythm to it, but what he's saying is just so awful. I can't listen to it.
You can always listen to the radio, the clean radio edit of DMX, which basically sounds like up and what and my dog and then like 30 seconds of silence. What? Right. And that is pretty much
it's true.
You're like, where's the song? But you still hear the beat.
You still hear the beat. Yeah. Maybe that one will go into like the more, you know, just vibe music.
Yeah, I love it. I have a playlist called Romeo Must Die on mine that has all that like very similar era of I kind of associate Romeo Must Die. Which for me, I was big into Jet Li, Kiss of the Dragon.
That movie, well, Romeo Must Die had like a big hip hop like
playlist. Yes, Aaliyah was in that.
Yeah, well, and like the whole soundtrack was like all hip hop.
Yeah.
And like contextually, people would watch it because they'd see Jet Li and they would expect a traditional martial arts film or something like that. And then you get like hip hop and they would. But it's such
a good movie. I couldn't get Lindsay to watch Romeo Must
Die. What? It was so beautiful when it came out.
Romeo Must Die where he does the pool ball? He kicks it and then
Kiss of the Dragon.
Kiss of the Dragon.
Okay. Yeah, which you should definitely, if anyone loves parkour, they have to understand Kiss of the Dragon is very, 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 very important, because this was a movie which I believe was directed by, is it Luc Besson? How do I pronounce? He's the same guy who did District 13.
Oh, really?
And Cyril Raphael is in Kiss of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. Does.
He's the guy that they fight in the bathroom, right?
It's in both.
And he does the narrow hallway bathroom, and they're like fighting side by side, and he does the kick like over his head.
Yeah,
that's him, right?
It
was such a dope scene.
There's a side flip like over a there's a good side flip over a like desk. Like Jet Li kicks a desk at him, and he like side flips over the desk, but it's like a parkour style side flip because Cyril Raphael did shows and stuff with the Yamakaze. I've been brushing up on my, well, a downtime COVID. I'm brushing up on my parkour history. So this is a very important movie because it's a place where like a Venn diagram, like Wushu and Hong Kong cinema and parkour has some overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, It was my
not kid friendly.
Not oh no, it's really bad. No. Yeah, like Jet Li.
The needles to the neck, right? Is that what it is?
In though, there's needles in it for sure. Needle to the neck.
Pretty much much anything Jet Li like past. Like,
yes, you're right. 2000. Yeah, right. It's the.
That's five the is like not kid friendly.
Yeah, it definitely gets a little more dark. But yeah, it was. He uses the secret like acupuncture technique,
yeah, okay,
where he stabs him in the neck, and then the guy like bleeds out of his nose.
Yeah, Romeo and Kiss of the Dragon both blend in my memory.
The so one as well, which is the one, which is where he has like the multi-dimensional.
The one.
Yeah.
That one's a little more kid friendly.
And then there's another
one. That one's violent, but it's not like.
Jet Li had a lot of violent stuff, and I don't know if that's he really did. And Jackie didn't go that route,
no.
But there really isn't there. But there are some, like, even now, there's some things you can't watch because there's just like the villains sort of are doing things like, you know, very like crass stuff, even in some of Jackie's older stuff. Because I tried to watch some with Nova when she was like 8, and I'm like, ooh, wait, we're not gonna sink prostitutes in the pool. That's not the Jackie Chan movie. Oh, how did this make it in? Like, what's going on here? All right, can we just jump on some ladders? So yeah, so definitely the point I want to make is that there was this period in the early 2000s where sort of Hong Kong cinema was sort of invited into Hollywood and became more present in a way that inspired us to move in different ways, because I know that that I was very affected by Cyril Raphael's work in Kiss of the Dragon, and I even did a demo, another little demo, stupid, you know, it's the high school stuff you do, it's really bad.
I love that you still yeah. have yours. I wish I had mine.
I knew. I always had the foresight to know, I'm like, this is stupid right now, but I know when I'm older, I'm going to want to look at myself and be like, that is dumb.
I honestly feel like they're still on YouTube. I just don't have that account, and I don't know what the title is.
Ooh.
But they're,
do you think your name's in it?
No, my name's definitely not in it. But they're certainly still out there somewhere.
Holy cow. That would be good. So, yeah, you've got to go back, watch your Kiss of the Dragon, watch your Royal Must Die, and understand that there was this relationship between, I think, hip-hop and Eastern culture, absolutely, in the early 2000s, and it made a lot of cool stuff to come over that later on would be permissible, like The Matrix. I know that stuff couldn't have happened if the popularity of Jet Li and Jackie Chan coming into Hollywood mm-hmm. hadn't grown, and I think even then Donnie Yen was doing some stuff too.
Yep.
So,
but anyways, yeah. Now we sidetrack onto cinema again because we get excited about these things.
Yeah, I think that is very useful knowledge. What's some other useful knowledge?
I guess a movie could be your hype. You know, if you got like a couple of I'm not gonna lie, mm-hmm. I've watched some Dragon Ball Z scenes before I work out.
Oh, dude, you should obviously tell them about that, because for a while we were doing that. Like, we were listening to the fight scene.
Oh, there was remixes. There was some really good, like, EDM would be the way, but more dubstep. But I'm not like a dubstep fan where they get too wubby.
It was
but,
pretty you know, wubby, bro.
Sometimes. But it wasn't like Skrillex wub.
No,
right?
It wasn't
like Rage Step, where it's just like, it's like somebody's in a kitchen just beating on everything they see. Like, that's what dubstep kind of feels like now. Like, there was actually still some, you know,
yep,
syncopated rhythms there. But anyways, yeah, no, so they would take like those scenes and they would cut in like the audio from the series into these dubstep tracks at like key points that would amp up.
They're
of
all
course,
builds,
it's like,
yeah.
that being like what I grew up on. And like, you know, yelling at my TV with Goku as like an 8-year-old kid, like, ah. Like, you know, like that felt good to me, right? And so like I would listen to those, or I'd watch like that clip before I work out, and that would be my like, that would get my CNS just like ready to go.
But yeah, I was going through like I think I was following like Juju Muhu's programming for like stretching, which was basically take a bunch of NSAIDs and then just get into the position you want to be in and hold a weight over your head and scream. So I was going through like rage yoga, and that was an interesting phase. I was just trying it out, you know, yeah. and I would listen to that stuff, and it just helped so much. It was so painful. So you just listen to like Goku like scream, ah, and you just have like alone in the gym with just a freaking like 45-pound plate on your back in the splits, just like, ah. It definitely complemented. I will say it was a challenge for the CNS. I'm pretty convinced that loading yourself in an end range of motion and then listening to rage metal is not good for...
There's some adrenal fatigue that happens, for sure.
100%. It's not a sustainable way to train all the time, but it's certainly enjoyable, like in the moment, to get you amped up. So
yeah.
So yeah, I guess I shouldn't limit it to just music. You could watch, like, if you have a particular scene or something from a movie, you YouTube that and you watch that scene to get you amped up. That could do the trick for you, and then you can go on to listen to NPR.
Wait,
don't tell
me. Try to stretch, like, because imagine this: you're just listening to like Goku, like just freaking annihilate, you know, Cell or something, and you're like, and there's that.
That was Gohan, bro.
Gohan did it.
Gohan,
dang man. So like, we'll do some freaking DBZ research. But anyway, so like, you're just like weight overhead, screaming in the middle split, and then the alternative is NPR. Like, can you imagine?
Oh, I could totally do it.
Justin could totally do it. Oh,
that is some stoic stuff. You know, a lot of Parkour people want to pursue the Stoics, but I think that's a super stoic thing.
It's pretty stoic. No, I consider myself the furthest thing from stoic.
Really? I don't think so.
I feel like I may present that, but stoic is a rough life, man.
Yeah, I think as advertised it is.
It's rough.
Oh, speaking of stoicism, I was working, because I was still following up on my New Year's resolution to treat the head game like I treat the physical game. And so some part of that has been researching the Stoics and Stoic meditation. And so I was like, Stoics have meditation. I found out. I'd heard of those, you know, meditations, obviously, but is it the same type of meditation that you would, you know, gather from the East or something like that? So it's similar in the sense it's a focused meditation. So I last Thursday had all four wisdom teeth out. And this is something I've been putting off for a while, but there are some Stoic meditations that are about observing sort of like the contrast of, like, you know, what you have in life, like, and then also imagining living in, like, so for example, you might imagine that you live in a world where such a treatment isn't available to you, and then your face just rots. I didn't have decay, by the way. I'm just saying. So your face rots, and you don't get medical attention, and then sad story, right? Again, this is Stoic. They are some sad guys sometimes. They say they're not, but I'm just not sold yet.
It's just like, it feels like Stoics, like, they're like always searching for that.
Yes.
The concept of, you know, overcoming obstacles and taking, you know, I guess like setbacks and pain as a learning experience. I just don't feel like that's super unique to Stoic.
It's not.
Right?
That's not a unique principle at all.
It's like the only thing they focus on.
I think that's what really emerges, but I agree with you. It feels to me like they were definitely, we're talking about Stoic history now, but it feels to me they were definitely working in a time when a lot of people had like these extremes, that they'd been to war and they'd seen atrocities and they were sort of put back in a pretty normal society. Yeah. And so you've got people who don't value what they have, and then people coming back with PTSD into that sort of odd, sort of like normalcy, that mundane life, and they're trying to deal with those things. Like, people who've suffered are trying to tell people who haven't suffered yet that they should be happy with what they have, and people who are, you know, are unaware of what they could lose are having to focus on those exercises, sort of like the exercise of, oh, there's some starving child in some undeveloped nation. You should be glad that you can have, you know, sushi at all, right? Right, so that's the kind of thing. So I did frame that up and then did a couple of meditations prior to the surgery where I was like, you know, really framing it as something I was trying to make a positive experience out of, really looking forward to it and seeing if I could get to that point. And it really did help. Like, I was literally, by the end of it, I was literally looking forward. Like, I woke up that day and I was excited because I imagined what it was going to be like to have the upgraded version of my mouth, essentially, the day after. It worked really well.
The lack of your vestigial teeth.
Right? The other meditation I did was mindfulness meditation, which helped me sort of separate any sort of anxiety or fear about pain or fear about, you know, using, I was under for anesthesia or whatnot. So I went in there and I was just, I mean, I was calm as a kitten. My heart rate was up, but the actual like anxiety, like what it felt to be there, was not bad at all. And I thought that was really great. Mm-hmm. I was happy about that. And the recovery process was pretty good too. That's so, yeah.
I mean, you're here talking.
Yeah, awesome. I was talking like the second day. Like, I did really well afterwards.
I told you, I was like, yeah, you're muggle level. Within a day.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
Like, you're not you level until, like, you know, a month out or something like that. Yeah. You can't do impact stuff. But yeah, I mean, you're a muggle level. You want to go to the store, talk to your friends.
Yeah, I was
eat ice cream. I'll never know. So,
you'll never know.
Do you? How did you not have wisdom teeth, or do they just have room for them?
Just didn't have them.
I stole all of your teeth.
Uh-huh. This is a funny story. So Justin was born without the incisors, right?
I think those are incisors.
Yeah, incisors, the ones on the outside of the two front teeth. Jesse was born with an extra set.
Yep.
But they're not. They're not twins. They're just born really. They're near twins. They're just born really close. A year, ish.
A year and 2 months.
Year and 2 months. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just really weird.
It's super weird.
You were born with his missing teeth.
I was born with Justin's teeth.
So it's like, the order makes sense too. You're born, and it's like someone threw in an order.
Where are they?
And they were like, oh, fries aren't up yet. they're done now. Send them in. Yeah. It's a wrong order. Just give them the extra fries. It's like when you go to they make the drink, the extra drink, and they make the wrong one. Hey, you know, I got an extra mocha. Like, hey, you want that?
You want it?
Yep. And exactly. Jesse said, sure. But, you know, unbeknownst to him, you don't need them.
Yeah. I got an extra set. Yeah, I had to have them surgically pulled out too, because like obviously once you're like your big boy teeth come in or they fall down, like they're there, right? And so the other ones are like, hey, we're coming too. And then the other guys are like, no, this is our house, we live here now, we're like, we're permanent residents. And so they were just kind of like, they would start to like push out like this way. And so when I got my tonsils removed, the doctor was like, you want us to just like chop those bad boys out there? And my mom thankfully was like, yeah,
do it.
She's like, can I watch? Oh, but I can't tell you how like nice it felt as like a kid to not have
extra
three
teeth?
Sets of teeth up here.
Yeah. Oh wow, how old are you?
I must have been 9 or 10.
Oh wow, that's serious.
Maybe a little older. Yeah. Actually, maybe 11.
I
don't remember my past very well. I don't have dates to all my memories.
Yeah,
Dustin doesn't either.
Yeah, I just people are like. My dad would always be like, well, you know, that was 1968. And I'd be like, I don't know. I can't tell you what 2006 was like. I don't.
Yeah. Carly asked me all the time. Like, she takes like a notebook. It's actually a super cool idea if you're into it. I don't like doing this kind of stuff, journaling. But so, like, she'll have, like, 365 days. And then every day she writes, like, what, like, her highlight of that day was. And so then there's like a 2017 highlight of the day of January 21st. Oh. And so as she's going through over the years, she can look back and she's always like, she's like, do you know, want to know what my highlight of the day was? Like, you know, in 2017. And I was like, babe, I don't remember 2020. So you're just
there was a pandemic, right?
I'm like, I don't even remember last week. Okay. So, but it's really cool to like look back.
Holy cow. That's such a positive thing. No wonder she's a positive. Like, that's really
she's
positive exercise.
When she goes outside of the house, yeah. I mean, she's not like a negative person at all. She's very happy, but she's an anxious little turkey.
Right. Right. I could see that. But, holy cow. So, all right.
Yeah, so like, you know, that those kind of positive things are pretty cool. And it matters how you talk to yourself, right? Like, that's really a big thing about like meditation. That's like talking to yourself and either reconciling bad things that you have or reconciling the good things that you have and being like, yo, that's where I need to put my focus on.
Yeah,
right now, right?
I feel like the Stoics were pretty good at that. Like their meditations are more like the meditations, like not to be, definitely they're serious. There could be serious issues like as into adulthood, but I would want like my daughter to start as like, you know, a freshman in high school or something like that to start considering Stoic meditations. Because some of the stuff is just so fundamental because so much of it is like, imagine you didn't have what you have. See how that makes you value what you have? And I'm just like, yeah, well, experience loss already, so this seems kind of elementary. Yeah. So a lot of it, to be honest, is like super, like a lot of framing exercises and a lot of sort of self-awareness exercises. So I think Stoicism is pretty cool and probably should be taught in at least, you know, yeah, like middle school or high school, maybe even earlier.
Definitely earlier.
If, as long as it doesn't send, yeah, you might need it earlier because it seems like when people hit puberty, they sort of, they're really susceptible to depression and anxiety, so that might just be the compounding effect of ignoring those conversations earlier on.
Because in high school it's tough, you're not going to get a class of high school students paying attention to any philosophy class.
Yeah, well, there are, yeah, that's when I became interested. When I was 14, I think, is when I started really getting into philosophy, but I'm a weirdo.
Yeah, but you were into like Eastern philosophy because you were into martial arts.
No, it actually came before.
Oh, really?
Yeah, philosophy came before martial arts. Yeah.
You're kind of a weird guy.
I am. Backwards. Yeah, that is weird. People always assume they're like, oh, so you get kung fu, and then you start looking at that. Like, I'm like, no, man, I didn't watch Star Wars until I was like 24.
Like, that's okay, you're not missing out on much. Yeah, Star Wars.
Like, I didn't, the Eastern thought stuff came first, and then later on, it was like, I guess I even was conscious of it. I'm like, I don't want to be like, you know, this seems kind of unoriginal to like become interested in martial arts because I'm interested in Eastern philosophy. But really, just it, you know, it was movement culture that was really very well developed and interesting, and that's where I became interested in it. But yeah, I went probably a year or two of studying Eastern thought before going after martial arts, kung fu, or anything.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Well, let's get on to our main topic, which has to do, since we're talking about philosophy, actually, we kind of segue on like how we talk to ourselves and
how do we talk to others?
How we talk to others, in particular, our students.
Yes. So when I look at what I could have used as an early coach, or even to be honest, just in general, I think about communication, and I hear self-awareness and communication come up a lot with advice for younger people from various people and mentors that I've been exposed to. And I feel that way too. I think that pretty much when you're younger, working on communication as a skill, and this is not the formal, like sort of, you know, it's Toastmasters.
It's not MLA citation kind of communication.
Right, exactly. We're talking about, when I talk about communication, I'm concerned about one thing, the efficacy of the message of like my intent, right? I'm just only concerned about effectiveness, really, when it comes to, I have one very simple goal. And for me, that is win. And win is get my idea across and then get the result that I want out of that idea. Not from a purely like manipulative sort of approach, but more like if I feel a particular way and I have a particular idea, I want other people to understand it through my lens. And then I want to also be able to understand what they think because it'll help me, right?
Yeah.
And I think that with coaching early on, it's a great opportunity to work on yourself when you're working with students. A very short period of time. They're only going to see you oftentimes in classes like for an hour. And that hour, I'm not really even sure what the window for attention is. It could be half an hour or it could be half a second. I mean, you got kids that are generally just sort of like following the vibe of a class. Mm-hmm. And I think all good orchestrators and facilitators believe that way. They have an overarching sense of the hum of the class and they're curating that, not having these one-offs. Right, with conversation. They can lead the group. So I think that's the initial intent, is to control that energy in the class or influence it. You can't really control it. And when you inject, it's sort of a take, but yeah. So I think that's really important.
I like the idea of if you're early on in your coaching and you're working with children in particular, it's a really good time to view that. It's very easy to be like, I'm here to teach. So I have the haves. And they have to have nots, and I'm just giving, right? But it's like, it's very much, it can be an experiment where if Justin's my student and I say, I throw out a cue for him and he does the entirely wrong thing, really I'm learning here because I'm like, ooh,
yeah,
that was a bad cue. What did I do wrong? Because I told him to do that and he didn't do it the way I wanted to, right? So if I think it's that's a pretty cool concept to be like, hey, you're there to learn too. And you might as well treat it as like, this is going to sound a little bad. These are like my little experiments.
Yeah,
like
no, the kids, right?
And like, and the experiment is how can I communicate effectively to them with the minimum effective words, if you will.
Yeah.
Right. To get them to do what I need them to do to learn the best. And you're getting constant feedback because when you're cueing a kid, and you're like making eye contact. I mean, sometimes you get kids that you get kids that just won't stop talking to you. Mm-hmm. And so then you're like, okay, cool. I've got one kid who takes my feedback like that. So my communication with him is on point. But now I have this kid that I give him a cue and then they want to talk to me about Star Wars. So how do I cue them that I want that connection, but I need them to stay focused, right? Like what words would I shift? Maybe instead of being like, oh my gosh, that was amazing. That was such a nice job, right? And like being, I'm just like, hey, good work. Right, to keep it short, sweet, right? Or something like that, where the communication cycle, I'm experimenting with that class to see. I like that idea.
I think cueing versus conversation is a critical point. Yeah. Because coaching in classes is more about nudging and depending on your audience.
Bumpers.
Yeah, bumpers, right? And then they're following a tone. And when you have a conversation, it splinters the attention down to one particular individual. So it's not oftentimes you have, you know, what is the 80-20, 20% of the class is calling for 80% of the attention or whatever, mm-hmm. right? And so you're kind of trying to balance that and avoid that. I think that a common tool that can be used is just paraphrasing, like just saying back what the kid is saying, right? So the kid's like, hey, do you watch, you know, like Nova's really into the Bakugans right now. So do you, yeah, I got a Bakugan. If I, this is kind of like Bakugan and blah, 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 blah. And be like, yeah, it is a bit like that, isn't it? And then just move on instead of like taking the time to really debate them about the parallels between their parkour training and Bakugan, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't need to be done then, because you're really just trying to ride that wave of momentum through the curriculum. It's still genuine,
right? Because you're not shutting them down.
Yes.
Right? That's a big no with a class, especially with kids. It's like, I've heard you say this a couple of times too, that it's like no or like stop or like these hard line negatives should never be things that you say to youth students. I would even say, like, don't say them to any students, but sometimes with adults are a different ballpark, right? Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes if you the clients like that, they're like, mm-hmm. they're into that weird.
Yeah, there are some people who are like,
coach.
You there is pay some me of that.
More for that one.
Yeah, exactly. You got to know.
But yeah, for kids, like those hardline no's, like what that tells the kid is that you don't care about them personally.
Yeah.
Right. Especially when they're like, oh my gosh, I got this new Bakugan from this. It's so cool. And it does. Do you know what Bakugan's order? And they're like, I know what Bakugan's order. And you're just like, hey, stop. They're like, oh, he doesn't like what I like.
Right.
He doesn't care what I like. Right. But if you do this simple, like, oh, that's really cool. Yeah. The rolls, like when they like go into the little ball, those are the little balls, right?
Sure. Yeah. It's the balls with the magnets on them.
Yeah. 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 Okay, mm-hmm. yeah. So they go into a ball. You'd be like, yeah, like, you know how they go into the, like the balls? That's like how we do on our rolls.
Mm hmm.
Right? Yeah. And like you're like bumper, boop, boop,
yep,
boop, back to parkour.
I've definitely seen kids take that, and then right when they're running for their like flip or their roll, it's like I can just the focus comes into it. I can just imagine that they're imagining themselves as like, yeah, whatever
little Bakugan ball,
yeah, whatever fantasy sci-fi thing. And they're like,
Bakugan tuck.
You see it sometimes. That one, I like, I'm always very careful on that one, because then I'm like, oh, this one's, it's gonna be like this for the rest of the class. It's going to be him in whatever world he's living in.
Yeah.
And me trying to direct that that imagination.
That's true. That's the thing, too, funny. Is like,
derailment.
This certainly happened to me. It happens to all coaches where, like, you're giving cues and you create a narrative for a drill, right? Like, obviously, if you're teaching a complex skill, you give cue one at a time, right? Like, start with this, like, start with the jump and then start with this part. And it's all supposed to build up on top. Have you guys ever gotten to the point where you've created that narrative and you've got pretty close to the end and they're just not clicking? And then you realize you're like, oh, that cue I gave way earlier is just,
yeah,
it's just totally wrong. And how do I reset this? Like, it's like mm-hmm. as if I told a kid in a front flip to do like a Bakugan tuck, right? And so every time he tucks, he keeps like doing yeah. this thing. And I'm like, that's not, I need you to do a forward somersault. But mm-hmm. how do I fix that? Because now he's in Bakugan world and like,
Yeah, I think you have to break the entire context at that point. You just pretend that drill is done, and you either make a new one or move on to the next one, where the context changes. I run into that with all ages, because people will be like, "But you said never, yep. blah blah blah," and so that's another reason why you don't say don't, no, and never. They'll remember it, and they will hold your feet to the fire. I've had people come back a year later and be like, but you said never put your foot like that. When? I don't know. And I'm like, man, I mean, I said that like last year or something. And so I'm like, ooh, just in general communication in absolutes, it has a risk.
Yeah.
When you communicate in absolutes, yeah. it's not like you're being wishy-washy if you don't, but anytime you communicate in absolute, anyone who takes that fixed position and sees it as rigid and has opposition to it in their own heads, right? Is going to come up and come in conflict with it. So always leave room, leave a little bit of an out for them to save face so they aren't humiliated, or if they have a different idea, we, you know, mm-hmm. let them not confront that completely in that minute. Give them an excuse. Just give it as an alternative, and the alternative that we're working on, right? So that redirect and as opposed to stop. So Dale Carnegie has a book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. He does courses. He's an author from you know, a long time ago.
Is he still around?
Like,
is he still
heck alive? No.
No, he's dead.
That's okay. Like, we're talking like
1940s
or something.
The book I had looked like it was 100 years old.
Yeah.
But how to win.
Yeah, he's old. He's friends. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so they have the three C's in that, and it's never complain, condemn, or criticize. And so the title sounds a little weird in the modern era. It sounds like maybe you don't have friends and you're trying to manipulate people. How to win friends and influence people. But really win in that context really means earn, how to earn friendships, mm-hmm. and how to like influence people. Might not be the best word for now. I think we would say something like be influential, right? Or lead by example or whatever, right? So the complaining, condemning, and criticizing are hard stops. You're gonna meet feedback from that. And I think that most of us should be able to get around the no, we don't do that, and just present an alternative and redirect as an option. But I think that one of the ones that really stands out to me that I want to talk about isn't sort of like criticism, and it's more like making fun of, even in light and playful, right? You know what I mean? It's like you aren't directly criticizing people being like, that jump sucked. You're just like, oh, there you go, blah, blah, blah. You know, this sort of passive, I see a lot in younger guys, right? I'm sure I was guilty of this at some point, where you say things like, well, that wasn't very good, was it? You know what I mean? Like, and you're also like sort of targeting an individual and then giving a sarcastic critique. I think there's really no place in sarcasm with coaching.
No, yeah.
And if you see me do it, it's because I've developed it as an art. So, you know, it takes time. And new coaches really struggle with sarcasm in teaching.
Sarcasm is so tough. It's such a subtle communication style.
And is there anything subtle about children?
Yeah. Yeah, they take everything for face value. And so, and the tone matters, and how loud your sarcasm is so important. So it's just, yeah, I never use sarcasm when I'm coaching kids. It's usually trying to create those mess ups, you know, when they fall or they trip, and trying to kind of like normalize those,
mm-hmm.
those, and use the small parts that were good and that were fun and that were correct, and then I'll get them somewhere and emphasize those. But if you are sarcastic about a fall, yeah, it's tough to come back from that, because they won't tell you right away. They'll just hold on mm-hmm. to it.
They just kind of clam up. They're quiet. They don't say anything.
Well, and that's the thing too, is that it's, you're never going to know how impactful what you said is to them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you'll give a short cue or something like that. And if you give a cue, sometimes all the cues you've given this person, never point your toes is the one that just happens to stick, even though you were talking about this one specific instance, mm-hmm. right? In this one specific drill, and it sticks with them forever, right? So the same thing applies with sarcasm too. And that if you make a joke like, you kind of look like a raptor, like a dying raptor when you mm-hmm. went for that thing, they're going to be like, I look like a dying raptor. Mm-hmm. That's just my aesthetic now, right? Mm-hmm. And even though it was like a sarcastic joke, but yes, side flip raptor is a real thing. Yeah. Front flip raptor is a real thing too, but the kids don't need to hear that.
No, you know? Use T-Rex arms.
T-Rex arms.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think saying things that are redirects and using words like can. I remember when I went through, Dale Carnegie has their institute or whatever, they do like 12-week courses. I remember mm-hmm. at some point in professional career going through for like, you know, 12 weeks bi-weekly trainings and meetings around communication, and you'd have to do drills where it was like, you couldn't say no. You could never say no. You couldn't say one of those like anti or like stop or negative words. You always had to reply, and it was your partner's job to troll you and try and get you to say no, and you always had to redirect. What we can do is, if this, then that. So if you guys go over here, then we can get to do something more fun, instead of saying, if you guys do blah, 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 then we can't go to the air track or the foam pit or whatever, or do this, play this game. You know, the if, then we, it, the can't, you just can't use it, right? So in my own words, I will rephrase that to say, if you focus on redirects and positive communication and telling people what they can do if they follow instructions, then you will have a more enjoyable class experience and the communication will be more effective, right? So it's always the if, then.
That's the big thing too, is that it's, I don't think, like, you're never going to, here I am using the never. You're most likely not going to cause, like, lifelong trauma to your kids if you don't have these things mastered, right? You're not going to damage them forever in their athletic careers. It's just not the most effective way to train them.
Right.
So even though for some groups saying, hey, guys, if we don't behave, we don't get to go do this cool game. Right. Even though that's like that's a negative reinforcement.
It's the stick over the carrot.
And it might work. It might work. The class might be like, oh, we really want to play that game. Let's focus. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just not the most effective for everybody. And it's just not the energy that you want to inject into your class. So, you know, saying something like, hey, guys, I really want to get to the game. But in order to get to the game, we have to refocus. Mm-hmm. Can we do that?
Yeah,
I think we can do that. And the class is like, oh, I want to get to the game, too. I can refocus. Sweet. That's the energy of, like, you're encouraging the class to keep moving, to keep on topic, to get better, as opposed to this, like, oh, you've strayed, and now I have to smack you with a stick to get you back
kind of thing. Right, so there's always that carrot and stick analogy where you're trying to lure someone a direction by holding a carrot on a stick in front instead of whacking them when they do things wrong. And that's just because whenever you employ those can'ts, no's, wants, hard stops, it's essentially the e-brake. You know what I mean? It's going to stop everything. It's going to bring everyone's attention to it. And it's going to be jarring from time to time. So when we use words like that provide direction and get attention going elsewhere, then the whole herd tends to follow that. It's when you're saying things like, no, can't stop, that people are now, they're in that mode where they're looking to be told what not to do. So they question everything they do.
Yep.
And then they get hung up. You don't want that kind of fluid. You want fluidity in your class. You don't want.
Yeah. If you have a list of things that students can't do, they're always just going to add to your list. So it's just better to say the things that you're looking for and the things that are going to be enjoyable for you and for the rest of the class. And just always redirect back to that rather than trying to add, don't climb on that. Don't jump on this. Don't be doing this while I'm doing that. And because that list will go on forever. Mm-hmm. Kids are masters at adding the, what can't I do?
And then that's like, it's like what their little brains are like wired to do right then is like, that looks hot. Can I touch that? Nope. Can't touch that. Mm-hmm. Right. And now they're like, I have a list. Can't touch hot things. Got it. Mm-hmm. Next. Right. Like they're not out there like, I can touch hot things. I can touch water. Like, you know, they're just out there trying to find the things that are going to kill them. Yeah. Like in their primal little reptilian brains. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. So you want to be like, no, here are things you can do.
Yeah. Do this, do that, because they can't. They have very limited control over their attention. That's a very good point, right? They have not yet discovered the ways of, you know, mental mastery. So they're literally just like, their attention is like a beam of light or like a, like you wound them up and they're just going to go. So you don't get to stop them. The wound up toy is on and it's going to go a direction. And if you point it at the wall and tell it not to go into the wall, it's just going to keep running into the wall. Because all I can think about now is wall, wall, wall. You have to turn it towards something else, which is the drill at hand, the task at hand, the next thing that is going to happen that's going to be fun when we endure a little bit of something else, right? So they won't understand those more, the framing in the same way when it's negative. The next biggest, I think, subtopic on this one is sort of the mood of a class. So this may be my biggest pet peeve with coaches interacting with students that I think I just see a lot of. I think this is this one simple fix will triple the happiness of your coaching experience, right? And that is when kids come around you or students come around you or others come around you, they're sort of playing off your energy when you're in the leadership role. And as a coach, you're in the leadership role. And there's sort of this sort of unspoken permissibility to act wild, to get in a mode that just sort of like crazy or resistant or wild in a way that makes the class unenjoyable and uncontrollable. And I think that comes from being too playful. There is a way, let me dig into that, because I know people are like, well, I'm playful, I'm never gonna not be playful when teaching parkour. There's a difference between being curiously playful and sort of disorderly and reckless. And when everything is a joke and everything is not that serious, and again, sarcasm is present, and you see that the kids, they'll play right off that and they look for ways to challenge that, and it damages trust. When someone has a sort of purity of intention in when they teach, and it's very simple and honest and straightforward and respectful, then they will follow. But you take a class that's used to be to having some mental gymnastics played against them, to trick them into doing things, or sarcasm, or sort of call them out or check them continuously, you're going to have problems bringing them back to that calm and that normal. And then you're also going to have a scenario where it's like the open gym versus class format syndrome. Yeah. If I let you come in and you get to run all over as a kid and do whatever you want, get on what you want to do and play, and this is where, like, okay, you guys, I'm going to let you guys go to this corner here. You guys are going to jump around. You got a little bit of free time to warm up while I build an obstacle. I see this a lot with coaching. Well, you've just told them there's no structure in this moment. Mm-hmm. And then now you're going to ask them to present structure in about 2 minutes or 5 minutes as you try to facilitate.
Yeah.
If they think that they're just putting in the work to get to the point when they get to be wild, then they're not going to respect that. And they're not going to carry a tone of focus throughout. Doesn't mean you can't have games. Yep. Games still have a focus. We're talking about free for all and sort of the energy where I'm coming down to you at your level in a way that almost makes you feel like you can be walked over. You can't go from, I let you walk over me right now, but in a minute, I'm going to be coach again.
Yeah.
That persona has to be established, and those boundaries have to be present, or they will swing from the rafters and, you know, tear up the carpet, chewing on things like little Milo or whatever from Korra.
Yeah, I free time and games are the two hardest ones to pull back from. And if they're at the end, then it's just kids just trying to do the most minimum amount of focus to get to that point.
Yep.
Where they can just be free. So I also think that, yeah, they're just, there is an element of focus and progression that everybody enjoys. Everybody enjoys realizing that they can do something new that they haven't been able to do before. That's like, there's a certain, I don't know what the experience of that is like. It's always hard to get it now that I've been doing parkour for so long. I'm jealous of the kids who can get progressions like that. But when that is the goal and that the kids are looking for is that next step in their move, that's much easier to direct and to enjoy being in that experience as a coach, right? A lot of it is I want to teach the class in a way that I enjoy it as well. Mm-hmm. And if the kid enjoys progression and I enjoy progression, it's just so much easier for that class to continue on for an hour. Whereas if it's like the kids want free time, but the free time stresses me out, it's always a battle between what I'm enjoying, what the kids are enjoying. So there is something about just doing progressions that is fun. And sometimes I think that coaches, it's easy to think that the only time kids have fun is playing a game. Mm-hmm. And that there's no fun in actually doing a Kong vault or swinging or doing a flip. But that's why we all started parkour. Because those things are so fun.
The irony is that if you ask most coaches what's rewarding for them, they'll be like, I really enjoy like accomplishing and unlocking these things. You know, like I really enjoy like working on a skill and finally getting it and being able to apply it to my practice, right? Like a, you know, cool flip or a Kong or something like that, and being able to do it in a line. And so it's very easy to just be like, so why would the same not apply to your students, right? Why would you think that the only thing your students care about is free time in games when you yourself just said that what you enjoy the most out of it is unlocking a skill and then being able to apply it. Mm-hmm. And that's really where your game or your free time should never be in a class, because I think regardless of where you are and what realm you're coaching in, somebody's paying you and they should never, you should value yourself too much to be a babysitter if mm-hmm. you're gonna call yourself a coach. And if you are a parent paying, you pay too much for free time for somebody, a coach, to watch your kid or you to do free time. That's ridiculous, right? Anyways, sidetrack. So
yeah.
My point just being that like, if you, yeah, I guess I get my point.
You're here for secret recipes. I mean, that's what I tried to deliver is like, there's something that I know that I figured out, and then that's what you came here for. Yeah. Right. That's why I'm the coach. If you just, I mean, you guys are the masters of free time. I'm not the master of free time.
Yeah.
So like if you guys want free time, you're going to do it better than I can deliver it. So I'm trying to give you guys the secret ingredient to these, you know, skills that you're trying to unlock for whatever reason, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think a lot started to sound like I was on a high horse there, so I wanted to cut myself off.
Oh, yeah.
No, yeah, I'm on the same page.
It should start with a way as a coach, you're framing your time as valuable, okay? Yeah. And you're framing your time as focused hard when you have a large class load to keep that focus. But that's a mental game for you. It's like, how loose is your mental game that you can't focus on a couple hours a week of interacting? Like, you have to look at your own distractions and be like, oof, man, you know, because, you know, I don't, you know, I had really bad Taco Bell before this or something. I just cannot get over the fact that, you know.
That one does supersede on a hierarchy of needs. Needing to go to the bathroom is a primal need.
That is a primal need, right? Okay, you're right. So.
But if you've taught your class or your students that the focus is where it needs to be, it is highly possible to be like, all right, I need you guys working on this drill that you're certain nobody's going to get hurt on, or this station or this thing. And then you're like, I got to go to the bathroom. I'm sorry. Because I've like maybe once or twice in the history of coaching, like, just had to straight up tell my class, like, guys, I got to go to the bathroom right now. Here's what I want you guys working on. Here's what it looks like. Right. And I demo it, and it's a super safe drill that I know nobody's going to get hurt on. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I know you guys can focus on this because you guys are awesome. I got to go to the bathroom. Give me 1 or 2 minutes, right? And I run to the bathroom. I come back. And they're still working on it. Or they're like, we did it 12 times. Mm. I'm like, that's 7.
Yeah.
Pick 3, my lord. Right? Like, that's intense. And I'm like, okay, but how many times did you actually do it?
Yeah.
Right? And they're like, okay, we did 5. But it's more like the reports.
But if you have, if they have the sense that they'll disappoint you, or they're going out of bounds, if they act a fool while you're absent, then you'll probably get a better result for that. If you're used to just free time, they're gonna just go to that. If you can't even go to the bathroom, if you don't even have enough structure set into the routine of your class that you can't be absent for 30 seconds, right? Well, like, wash your hands for another 20, so minute, okay? All right. And so that's a reward of having a class that has good attention and good structure. The content piece, like the idea that so what Justin is saying that I want to double down on is the reward, the experience happens at different levels. You should be coaching to the level of the student that they're at and trying to imagine where you were at when you were at that stage, not in a way that makes you feel like you're bored because your focus right now is on, you know, this massive precision or this big flip, and so you're disinterested in cartwheels. Like, I love to teach those basics and see people break through those little barriers and then focus on the little elements of quality that, man, if I would have started doing my cartwheel this way when I started, I would have been better set up for like a full, you know, I would have been able to target better for coming off obstacles. I've taught cartwheel 4 lessons in a row in the most recent class I've been teaching for style. That's 4 only cartwheels and their variations, all right, for 4 lessons. And the class is growing. People are still interested. I don't believe there's that much of a difference between kids and adults in that manner, as long as you're able to reframe the cartwheel. And I think that the skip to the next big move is another big problem that we see in coaching, where it's like, okay, can you do a front flip? Yes. Let's double it.
Yep.
Backflip? Sounds good. Time for 2.
Yep. Well, we've, aside from the obvious, like, skill gap that is there, right? Like, to do a front flip requires skill. To do a double isn't like the next level. Like, there's a wide margin between the two, right? But I've never been a fan of it anyways, simply because it's just not mentally enjoyable enough, the progression there, right? It's like when there's such a, like, there's a whole buffet table here, and then there's another buffet table back there, and you're just standing and looking only this way, right? Like, you see your plate of, like, beef here, and then you're like, oh, and there's steak back there.
More beef.
And that's it. That's all you see is just beef and more beef. Mm-hmm. And then that's it. Whereas, like,
you can try potatoes.
You spend your whole dinner
right across this table, right? Like, there's so much. And then maybe if you want, you go to that table, grab something, come back.
And so I think that's another thing that happens. If you focus too much on things like that and those linear skill sets, then you get this really big spread in your class. You end up with a student that you feel like deserves a lot of attention because they're better and more naturally talented as an athlete. And you end up with a group of people who aren't paying attention. And some people in the middle who usually get the worst of it because they're not getting the attention of the high level athlete and they're not getting the attention of the distracted struggler. And these are people who are just trying to follow the flow. Focus on them. They're your critical mass. They are the ones that others will orbit around, and you can sort of tweak, you know. You can ask a kid who's a little bit stronger, you can try a one-handed variation. Or, hey, when you do your setup now, I want you to focus on this shape, because later on that's going to make you jump real big. But I don't tell that to everybody. You know, you can say stuff like that, and they're like, oh, they just want to know how to get better. And so if you don't believe that everyone's there to get better, or you don't believe that everyone's there to have a particular feeling and experience, then it's going to be really tough to draw on that for inspiration when you're just looking for ways to communicate. It doesn't come from anywhere planned. You will never script your classes. It's coming from a place that you don't even understand. Like, you get in that state of coaching and you don't even know what the next word is going to come out of your mouth. That's where you have to pay very close attention to patterns and intention in your communication. Mm-hmm. Where do you feel like you're coming from in that moment? Are you checking yourself before coming into class to make sure that the energy is there and it's calibrated and it's right? You fix that upstream, you fix the problems. Otherwise, you're gonna be micromanaging your poor communication style into oblivion, right? With these gotchas of yourself. So you have to check it early on and check how you're approaching the class. I still think that, you wanna say something? I still think that the big one that I wanna take a second to loop back on again is this: trying to be able to skip channel from disarray, from being loud and screaming, crazy, run around, free time, just sort of step back and look at how great it is to be a kid approach to observing coaching, you know, wiling out so you don't have to put so much intention and sweat into that moment of coaching, and find a way to make things interesting and create that narrative and write that story for those kids and adults. You know, there's a cost. You will struggle to maintain control of your class, and you will struggle to not, you'll be struggled because you'll feel like you'll be treated. So here's this simp: if you're being treated poorly, that is symptomatic of you not putting yourself in the right framing and esteem as a leader in that class. If you have kids trolling you, don't tell them you're not taking me seriously because, I don't know, because you need to understand that I'm here to coach you and help you, and you're not doing that right now. Like, that, no. You, leading by example means that you hold yourself in a particular esteem and your interests and your goals in a particular esteem, and that's clear. People will feed off that, and they'll be inspired by it. When I look back at my coaches, the ones that, like, I had a lot of coaches, but the ones I remember and I'm drawn back to have a natural curiosity in what it is that they're always looking to find a deeper way or be more engaged with what the subject matter is. Mm-hmm. And that shows, okay?
And I was just going to say, too, as you had started, it kind of popped into my head that of the teachers and coaches and mentors that I've had, the ones that I care about and remember are always the ones that had that, like, very clear, like, this was their thing and this wasn't just, like, their side hustle, right, that they're mm-hmm. just, like, kind of doing. And they're never the people that I was like, oh yeah, I had that one high school teacher that loves to make paper airplanes and just, like, throw them around. And he was like, oh yeah, put on your phones, do whatever, like, as long as you guys read the book, right? Like, those aren't the professors that I remember. The ones that I do remember are the ones that are like, no, this is what we're doing, right? This is our focus and this is our topic. And then they rewarded appropriately for staying focused, right? But they were always very much, like, on top of their topics. They were never scrambled. They never came into class and were like, so for today, free time and movie, right? Like, those are, like, the teachers that you remember from high school were always the ones that were genuine and engaged and mm-hmm. focused. And the same thing with the coaches. Like, the coaches, otherwise you're just a worker at, like, a trampoline park, and nobody remembers those guys, right?
Not they can't even trick.
Now, if you're like, yeah, there's, if you, like, work at a trampoline, like, a park, couple... no offense, but I mean, you're just there to supervise, right? You're not there to engage.
You're there to police. Right? Where, you know, and that's why I've always had conflict with open gyms. And I feel like we've been able to find a happy medium with that when we do it, like, our sort of are sessioning together at the end of like our overdrive program. So we don't just let people do whatever they want, in the sense that run around and kissy face in the foam pit type of stuff. It's like you get the opportunity to pick a way to go back in time and work on the drill that you didn't get in class. Mm-hmm. You can, the thing you've been dreaming about all day in school on your iPhone, thinking, oh man, I really want to try that technique. I think I slept on it. I think I imagined myself doing it. Or you're like, oh, I'm at the Bakugan, and now it's time for me to slay this Bakugan course right in your head. Fine. Okay. That's that type of attention we all value and love.
God, I love kids.
And we want to see that happen. And it's our job to facilitate that. And that type of facilitation, to be honest, is sometimes even harder than class facilitation.
It certainly
is. To draw that energy out. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're that's what I would want to see more of and promote. So it's not ever that I think a lot of people might look and say, oh, well, they want this to run to some degree like a really strict martial arts school where you come in, you just do your thing, and there's never time to train on your own or have that freedom. I truly believe in freedom, but I also believe that freedom and flow and that at that level is something to be mastered. There's a difference between just like reckless disregard of space and time and sort of unpredictable natural arising of inspiration in your training and being able to move like that. And that takes a master to be able to facilitate in that environment and a chemistry that has to be harnessed as a whole. And you got to be the mad scientist trying to figure that stuff out. So that brings me to the next point, general curiosity in coaching, right? Like this coaching is the work. That is the project. The project is you're there trying to figure out a better experience and a better way to learn so that future generations don't have to make your mistakes, but they can enjoy what you've enjoyed. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. There has to be a genuine curiosity and interest in what it's like to be in a class. And you have to want and care and know about that to be a good coach.
Yeah. Because the entire purpose of coaching is to share your enjoyments of what you're doing and insulate them from your failures.
Yeah. Mitigate right? at a minimum.
Right. It's like I'm here because I want to give you all the same joy around this particular topic that I have experienced without you having to go through the negative aspects of it, maybe the trial and error, the injuries, you know, the failed drills, whatever it may be, right? And if you keep that focus as you're coaching, that it's like, how my entire goal is to share my joy, not to share my negatives, right? But prevent those and be like, look, all it is in my class, it's all about like the enjoyment of parkour, the accomplishments of it, the good feelings of it, the community aspects, right? And you keep your focus on that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's telling and troubling when people say without open gym, you can't have community. You know, it's like my deepest community connections in training has been with groups that train together, that sweat together, that play together. In formats of structure, and yes, there are release valves to that where there is less structure, but the core of my training was in exploration and in the pursuit of growth. Like that has to be positioned there in your mind. It has to be positioned there. So I think that's another really big one. I think the majority of stuff can problems in classes and just in general improvement can happen when things are a little softer on the edges. And there's just really clear direction as to what you want to be working on. I think that one of the other other direction, over coaching, isolating, focusing on one or two individuals, and then the compulsion to be over too exacting can be a problem too. Meaning like if I'm obsessed with something being done a particular way. Nope, this is how we do it. Nope, that's how that's the rule. That's how it goes. Mm. Valuing gains and just steady progression, that's the name of the game, over like an absolute critique of how perfect things are supposed to be. Because you can be a bit neurotic and a bit rulesy. Oh, nope, I want it to look exactly like this. We do it like that. We don't put our feet like that. Let's talk a little about coaching dogma.
Yeah, we do five reps, only five reps.
Five that's reps. Six. You always do the 5-5-5s and the five reps because that's what, you know, was said. Ripito said it. That's all we're doing ever. So let's talk about coaching dogma again in the absolutes and the beliefs that end things being taken too seriously. What are scenarios where you guys feel like when things are taken too seriously, Justin? We need some more airtime with your... You're a wise guy at this. You need to share some secrets.
Yeah, I don't have any absolutes off the top of my head right now.
No, like, what are the common dogmas that you see that people, like, get hung up on?
Yeah, I don't have anything off the top of my head right now.
He isn't even dogmatic about dogma.
Yeah.
Some next level stuff right there. Yeah. So, Justin, you, I think of the people who have probably trained me the most in parkour, formally or semi-formally, or I would say that I've grown from, you're probably my biggest influence when it comes to coaching. Like, if I was going to say someone coached me and I had to put the most chips in someone's bucket, like, parkour is a very autonomous thing. We talked about this the other day. We really grow together. It's not your traditional environment, or we weren't raised that way, where you really had a direct lineage and then you followed that lineage and you just were 80% of that teacher, 90% of that teacher, and then later on you made stuff up. It's really a sort of like a work in progress self-study for most people. You can't tie a direct lineage like that. But I gained probably the most from you, as I did from really anyone, proportionately. When you're coaching and when you've worked with people in the past, like, what are your top tips? And if you can't think of them, I can point some out.
Yeah, Justin does do a lot of his stuff rather organically.
Yes.
I mean, not to take away any intentions that you do put into your class, but it does seem like a lot of these things just come from your personality.
Yeah, I don't have like coaching like principles or that I feel like I'm.
What's your intention? So let's go work it out.
My intention is to be authentic when I'm coaching in there.
And what does authenticity mean to you? Because for some people that's very sincere, and other people that's just being an asshole.
Yeah, it's true. It would be that I want to enjoy the experience of someone else learning something new, and not directly as a result from my coaching, but just being there and that experience and helping them get to that, you know, new step, new progression, being there and helping them nudge that in a way and making sure that they're not going the wrong way or that they're wasting their time.
So what about when you're stuck with a student who you've given a progression and they don't get it? What changes in your mind when you're working with them?
And they don't get it.
Yeah, like they're failing through a progression.
You know, I just feel like that progression would be the wrong direction or too difficult, or that it's just not the right time for that one, maybe. If I know that progression works, I've seen it work for plenty of other people, I would just redirect and go around that corner or around that obstacle.
Mm. So how do you handle when you're frustrated with a student's sort of ability to do something? Do you ever feel that?
No, I actually don't
feel okay, like so I'm just going to go ahead and call out take 30 of whatever video we would have made in the past or whatever. Yeah. Where things aren't looking as clean as you want them to look.
Yeah.
What's your approach? How do you get that to work?
I feel like that frustration comes from a misaligned expectation. Mm-hmm. You're expecting your student to be better, or you're expecting them to look like you or something, or whatever video you just got done watching. So yeah, I would just realign my expectations to what the student is going to enjoy and what the student is gonna, you know, be capable of doing safely, and make sure that is where my progressions are leading.
That's good, because it's coaching is cause and effect, but if the effect isn't there, the expectation might not be well calibrated. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that for a second. What's the appropriate expectation for students? Let's say the variable is age and ability.
Expectation for students.
Yeah. So I think that what I observe is that it appears that many coaches or many people hold an expectation that's sort of a standard, and that's where their head's at, and that's what they believe. And then everyone else must adhere to their expectations. Or is it more fragmented? Do you have multiple expectations for multiple students at multiple levels? And how do you determine your standard?
Ooh, it definitely changes per student.
Yeah, and I would say that it as a broad overarching, you can't. It depends. If you're coaching high level athletes, you do need some sort of expectation that you are going to accomplish something today.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that expectation should also apply to just the casual like rec program you might be coaching, right? Or just the like kids are just there to have fun. Mm-hmm. They still need to accomplish something skill wise. So that should always be an expectation that like, we're going to finish class today accomplishing something new. Mm-hmm. Whether that's like, we don't really do cartwheels this way, and now we're going to turn the hand this way, and that's our accomplishment, because that's a new skill, right? That's a change. It's a variable that we've added to the skill. But it's absolutely got to change from kid to kid on the micro level, right? I might expect this kid to get this accomplishment here and this kid to get this accomplishment here, or I'm going to, my expectation is I get them closer there.
Yep.
Right. So I think you have to measure your expectations in two ways. One, your expectations for the kids and your expectations around what you are going to do today, right? What they're going to do, what you're going to do. What I'm going to do is I'm going to push you closer to the skill in a measurable step towards whatever skill we're working. Whether that's a big step, small step, doesn't matter to me. If I finish the class and you're a half step closer, I did my job and I'm happy. And you are what you're going to do is hopefully enjoy it should be the very first one, right? Mm-hmm. Like the expectation should be that you enjoyed what we did. And if that expectation's met, then
nice. Yeah.
I mean, everything else crumbles from that point, right?
I think that so much of feeling like, I feel like the expectation, if there is a global expectation, it's gradual progress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the only way to observe gradual progress is if you as a coach understand how to articulate when there is some progress and many different ways of doing that, right? So if you are working on balance or Kongs or a flip progression, being able to call out little bits of progress, oh, that was good. Oh, your foot was in a better spot that time. Okay, I like it. Oh, the chest. Okay, good. Chest is open there. That's good. Oh, your hands were in the right spot. You know, that's better. That was better than the last two. You know, saying stuff like that is really going to make them feel less bored and more attention because they're getting that positive feedback loop. Mm-hmm. So establishing a positive feedback loop around expectations is what's most important. It may be impractical, but the skill set of being able to continuously teach someone, let's just say something simple, like 6 feet of rail balance, time after time again. Like I imagine that like a master coach would be able to, or facilitator anyway, if their goal wasn't to make the best, performing athlete, would be they could teach a lesson on walking down that rail for years, multiple days a week, making different ways of communicating in it interesting. You don't need to have that dry. We have so many options. Just now we were talking about this last night. When I was training martial arts and I was younger, or my early like training in classes, and when I did other programs, like some of the other like natural movement programs and stuff I did, the progress was so, so slow because they weren't feeding me new skills. There wasn't a velocity to my learning that was appropriate for how fast I could learn, adapt, and what I could achieve. Mm-hmm. But still, those teachers were really good, so they made me feel okay with that. So there is a balance between that betrayal of progress and the unnecessary risk of, say, taking level 2 students to 8-foot rail balance just because it'd be good for them to work with fear, or they're going to need it one day anyway. I mean, the kids are 8 to 10. They don't need to be that high. I truly do not believe that. They're just not needed. And it's because there's so much more in between. If people can devise, like, what is, like, there are some firms that are completely devised of crawling, and that's all they do is crawl. And today we crawl like a tiger, and tomorrow we crawl like a lizard, and people pay them money, and they stay there for a very long time.
It's like elementary PE.
Yeah.
The entire time. It's like, we're going to do bear crawl, I guess preschool. Bear crawl and crab crawl.
Right?
Cat crawl. All sorts of other animal crawls.
Animal crawls, right? So which is,
and it entertains 3-year-olds.
Right, right. And but a master coach, yeah, exactly. But a master coach could make that interesting and entertaining for you because they're a master facilitator, and there's that skill set. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't think that that's what we're looking for, or what a good parkour coach or any other good movement coach is. They're looking for the appropriate velocity of the introduction of techniques. Is it age appropriate? Is it skill level appropriate? Is it what they've committed to, right? We don't train people like pro athletes unless they're trying to, they're outwardly saying, this is what I want to do. Don't have that expectation that's where they need to
that's
be.
That's a big one, is an expectation of where your student wants to be, right? You don't know where your students want to be unless, have you asked your students, like, what do you want out of parkour,
right? And if they're like, I'm here to have fun because I love parkour, or they're like, oh, someday I'm gonna compete at the national level and I'm gonna win, right? Those kids are totally different.
Yeah.
Right. And you're right. A lot of coaches make that flaw of like, no, this is how the elites train, and like this, we gotta be really focused and on our training. And it's like, that might not be what your kids want. So expecting that of them is wrong.
Everyone is annoyed by this. Their parents saying, well, this is the way I grew up, and this is the way I learned, mm-hmm. and this is how I had to do it, and you're gonna learn it that way too. No one wants to hear that, especially parkour people.
Yeah.
It's philosophically.
So why are you taking that like to why might you, because I'm not judging everyone on it. I just think it pops up every now and again. Why bring that same behavior into coaching and say, well, you know, one day you're gonna be outside, you're gonna hit a rusty rail and it's gonna be like this and blah blah blah. You don't know that. Maybe they hate rails, I don't know. But you're gonna try and give them more
hate outside.
Right.
In which case, that's their prerogative.
So you have to, right? You have to understand the context. It's 1 hour, right? Once a week. And then I hold the belief with my students that time will tell. If someone comes in and they say, hey, I'm ready to go, I've been watching this stuff, I've been training outside, I've been throwing flips. Oh, look, he's got a cork. Oh, look, he's got like a 9-foot broad jump and he's 6, right? So he's coming in here hot. We got to do so. We got a hot tater on our hands. We got to do something. We got to make this person a pro. Like tomorrow, what are we going to do? They're going to get bored. Oh my gosh. Right? You know, it's sort of like take a step back because time will tell. Part of growth is steady, like improvement over time. So let them wait it out. It's not that big of a deal. Yeah. What most of the kids, I think right now, our average, you know, student is going to stay somewhere between, I think it ends up being a year and a half as an average, but the typical person is probably staying 9 months, and then they may come back for another cycle or not and do some more training with us. We're looking at like 9 months to 2 years for 80% of the kids who are going to walk through this door, and they're going to do it between the ages of 8 and 12, or they're going to come back as an adult who's already broken or doesn't have an appropriate sport or is just looking to get better and grow or maybe do what their kids do. That's who the typical student is going to be.
Yeah, I also think that the typical student probably doesn't have any inclination to do parkour outside in a capacity that you think that they want to.
Not in the capacity that you think or expect.
I think every kid goes around and jumps on a playground, but I think most people want to do parkour in a place that was designed for it, because I think that there is an expectation around those obstacles that you will do something cool and enjoyable and something that you can't do anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when I hear the, like, because this was a big thing back in parkour, was that like, are you really doing parkour if you're doing it in a gym? Is that real parkour? Like, that question feels so damaging to me, because so many people come in here, they weren't doing parkour before, but now they're doing it because the gym exists and because the obstacles were made for them to be done in that way. So when we like build these gyms so that people, I originally built the gym so that we could train them, and then that maybe we'd go outside and we'd learn new things. But right now it feels like we built the gyms to do parkour, but then we don't want them to do parkour in the gym. We want them to do it outside. And so we only teach things in the gym so that you can take them outside. But it just feels like sometimes people just want to do it here and enjoy it here because it's here for that purpose.
Yeah.
So you don't need to force that on them. You don't need to push them and say, oh, you can't do that like that because it won't work outside. Like, it works here.
It's just
it's enjoyable here.
The analogy of that is just like people who are like, no, you need to know how to like write with your hand.
Oh, it's cursive. Cursive. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you need to learn how to write cursive. It's super important. And I do think handwriting is super important, because when you do write letters to people, it's very impactful. And if it looks like chicken scratches, nobody likes that. But whatever. Right? That's irrelevant. Writing cursive. And it's like, are you really going to waste 6 months of this kid's time teaching him cursive when you could teach him math or sciences or painting would be better than writing cursive, right? Like there are other things that you could spend your time doing with these kids. That's this. And I feel like that argument is the same thing when people are like, well, training parkour in a gym doesn't mimic what it's like outside. Mm-hmm. So what? Mm-hmm. If the kid just wants to do parkour in the gym, let them.
Time will tell. It's just like you go to school. This is just your little introduction, your exposure, your gen ed stuff. It's parkour. It's approachable parkour. That's what we're working on. It's in the vision. It's approachable parkour. Now, these words are coming from people who can do stuff, right?
Yeah. So
this should be acknowledged. Yeah. Jesse's an ambidextrous cursive writer and world-class parkour athlete. Is not coming from the opinion section of, you know, runningnaturally.com.
And I've spent a lot of time on my handwriting, right? But that's the thing that I care about,
mm-hmm.
right? If I'm not going to push that on somebody else if they don't care about handwriting.
Your early experience in parkour, all the way up through, in my if I could present this as a particular way, I would say there are a couple goals of the gym. That are more global. Some of those are, or in generally the way I think coaching and our style or model should be done. And that is, number one, continue to say it, don't betray your childhood self. And what I mean by that is don't break people. Don't put your expectations on people in a way that doesn't build on their experience, but makes them feel bad about what they're doing. So don't be like, oh, what you're doing in the gym, it's not really parkour. It's like somebody who studies martial arts and be like, oh, you know, oh, you guys just grapple. Well, I can't kick you in the face, so it's not really martial arts, right? It's like you're working on a skill and a competence. It's real. It's here. It can be observed. It's beautiful in its own right. Give it some credit. Let it be. You got a different style of doing things or you want to add something on. That's fine. It's just another skill, okay? Let them discover that. Don't force that stuff on them.
Yep.
With this idea that we've got to have these pro athletes at 12, is you see what happens in traditional sports. It's damaging. They get injured. You put such an emphasis on them, you break them early on. Don't break them. That's not that. Don't betray them. Don't betray your childhood self. Don't betray them as children, even as new learners, as young students, as if they're older. They're coming here with like this naive trust in you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you break unethical.
Yep.
So you have to be very gentle. Oh, you choose your path. Okay, you can choose. I'm going to expose you to this buffet and you choose. Oh, you want to be the best? Oh, cool. Stick around. You'll get there. And then let time tell. Let them discover themselves. They are to be discovered, not don't graft this stuff on them. Now, on the flip side of that, we obviously need some structure, but that's why we have the bands and the challenges and the curriculum is because there are things that generally should be exposed that are less risk but build a good foundation that we're trying to guide them through. But it's when we skip level or have these misappropriate or inappropriate expectations of what they should be doing, and whether it's the nature of it or the athleticism of it, that I think we're gonna run into conflict when coaching generally, like Justin said.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot to chew on.
That's a lot. I was just gonna say, I think this might be like one of our longest.
It is, but it's important.
But it's
we gotta scratch our own itch.
And regardless of what realm you're coaching, most of the stuff is gonna apply to, you know, different sports have different goals, right? Athletes who are in a competitive traditional sport are obviously in it to compete. So your training is gonna be arguably a little bit different, and you can expect that your kids coming into the sport are wanting to compete, right? Which is not a thing that a parkour coach can expect of all of their kids. So there are some subtle differences, you know, when you apply it to your students, or when you, I guess, if you're a student looking at your coach and you're like, is my coach a good coach? It's kind of mean, but I guess it's a question you got to ask yourself. But yeah, so, you know, apply your sports or your field's context over the tips. But
so let's end on this
meditation. Yeah, because we could keep going for another hour.
Okay. Also, when I did, I think it was Dale Carnegie? I think it was Dale Carnegie. There's an exercise you do, and it's called your retirement speech. And basically, this is a way to frame up how you approach coaching. And you're supposed to take time to write a short 2-minute speech describing what's happening at your retirement speech. You're at a buffet. Maybe it's in the future. It's under a pandemic, socially distanced, or it's Zoom calls or whatever. So you imagine that all people who showed up, that's the first thing. You're there. Who showed up? And then people are going to say things about you and describe you. What do you like and want them to or not? It's not an exercise of do you want people to speak at your wedding or not. It's an exercise of they're going to say stuff. Some people are going to show up, some people aren't, and they're going to say stuff. What are they going to say? And then what do you want them to say? And then use that to frame up how you approach your journey, how you approach your story. And you also have to ask yourself, what changes do you need to make? And then ask yourself, would anyone show up right now? And if they did, what do I think they would say? What's current state? What's my desired state? What would I want them to say? and what do I need to change about my approach to just not work for anything, but more applicably to this situation, what would your students say? You're at your retirement speech. They showed up. I don't even remember that guy. Oh, yeah, him. He was kind of a jerk. Oh, yeah, I remember. He was like, no, you can do it. And the 8-foot gap didn't work out. So now my ankle's busted forever. You know, are you going to be the guy who had there? I said, well, I was used to do parkour, but we used to see parents come in like that. I used to do backflips. What happened? Well, I shattered my Achilles and blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? So those are the stories that we want to meditate on and think about. You know, what if they say, oh man, this person made me want to do something else, made me want to be better. They always had energy. They're positive. I learned a lot from them. I would love to have them show up later on and look at my, observe my accomplishments, right? I considered them a mentor. They inspired me. That's the kind of stuff you're probably going to want to hear. So ask yourself, who's going to show up? Who's going to say that? And if you feel like it's not your students, why? Why not?
You got to ask yourself the hard questions on that one. I like that exercise. I'm going to go home and do that, actually.
Ooh, it's a good, it's a tough one.
After our lunch meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Scary one, yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
I also want to shout out, like, if you don't do parkour and you somehow made it to the end of this podcast, thanks. But also, like, nobody ever wants to hear that you used to do parkour, right? I also used to do surgery when I played, what's that little zapper game?
Operation.
I didn't like that one.
Okay. I also used to do surgery when I was a kid playing Operation. Okay. No, I didn't. I'm not a surgeon. I've never done surgery. I was never a medical professional. Like, so you jumping on a playground or doing dumb shit with your friends is not parkour. You didn't used to do parkour. Okay. I want to share that memory because I did dumb stuff too, but don't be like, I used to do parkour. Or I used to be able to do that stuff. No, you just had fun as a kid and that's cool. And that's awesome. Just claim that, please.
Just don't hold his ability. It's as high esteem.
It's trauma from like just the 15 years of hearing people say, I used to do parkour. It's like going up to somebody who's so proud of their accomplishment, right? Like a kid who like built like a volcano for a science project, and you going up and just being like, oh yeah, so I used to do that all the time with my friends. And the kid's like, oh, but this was like a thing. This is like my thing. I worked really hard on it. And you just like used to do it, supposedly. And now you stop because it's not that cool or something. It's just, it's rude.
It's not well understood.
It's rude. It's just, yeah. I mean, I know they're not intending it that way, but.
Yeah. But so, you don't hear people go up and say, oh, you baseball, I used to do that all the time when they just had like a stick in an apple orchard with.
Yeah. Well, and even if you did play baseball with your friends, like.
It might not be the same.
Okay.
Level. Yeah.
Like, I think I just expect that you were a kid as a kid. You don't have to tell me that.
Weird like that. There's just some. Something about the name. Like, I feel like parkour, the name parkour is too fun to say. And people just like saying parkour.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, that's another thing. Like, so that. I've said it on several podcasts. Too,
you know? Yeah.
But, okay. Yeah, stop saying that one. Please, no more hardcore parkour. It's not, it's a slur at this point.
Yes. It did not
either. Anyways. My high horse. I'm going to hop off of my high parkour horse.
It's your pony. Get off your pony.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. If you are listening to us, you can watch us on YouTube. And if you are watching on YouTube, you can listen to us on any of the major podcast platforms. Thanks for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Peace.